Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show.
Dan, there's just so many problems. How are we going to cover this in 1 hour? This thing is just rife with errors. Are we going to pick into like every typo, every misspelling, every poor layout issue?
I mean, you know, I'm pretty sensitive to those kinds of things, so we'll see how much time we have for that stuff. Yeah. Do you mind that I made the cover thumbnail like sort of a mixture of you and me? Do you mind that?
I think it's great. I'm sure no one will notice.
Yeah.
Oh, we're live, Dan. Time. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about mistakes in original D&D. And, you know, as much as we love it, we do think there were some obvious glaring errors in the initial 1974 publication. We're going to hash out what they are and what's been done to correct them, and we'll see if I agree with Paul, if Paul agrees with me, or the viewer agrees with either of us. All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we begin, I will remind everyone that at the end of the show, we will have our after-party chat, where Dan and I will host a live video chat with all of our patrons and continue to disagree on what is and is not wrong with the original D&D. If you want to join in on that...
I don't think so, Paul. I think we're going to agree.
You're absolutely wrong, Dan. if you want to join in on that, you can do so by joining our Patreon. That's at patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier. One of the perks you will get is an invite to our private Discord server. Get that going during the show, and around 2 p.m. Eastern, or maybe 10 minutes after, Dan and I will be there to host the after-party chat. We'll hope to see you there.
Yeah, it's part of our favorite part of the week. And also, hopefully we'll hang out for the end of this show when we're going to have a special announcement about our featured guest for next week. So please hang around for that.
Excellent. Excellent. So, Dan, how do you want to do this? You got some big ticket items, or should I just start on page one?
We should probably stick to it. We should probably pick some choice selections, probably, yeah. Paul, because I do agree. We don't need to get into layout. We don't need to get into typo issues. That probably will be. So we should probably take some big ticket items. Yeah. Also, I'm going to throw in a thank you to our patron Josh for having the idea for this show a while back. And again, we listen carefully to our viewers, and if you have ideas on our Patreon, on our Discord server, we always love to hear them. So, how about this, Paul? I'm gonna pick what I think is the single biggest mistake that was made in early D&D. You ready for it?
Yeah, sure.
And I have an image for this. It's kind of small text. It's got a blue dot on it. And I would say among the things that irritate me the most about early D&D is the darkness spell. The darkness spell. That's right. Because in when D&D was published, the darkness spell became this like magical blob of blackness, which doesn't make any sense. And if you go back to the text in Chainmail, which we have on screen right now from the prior game, it made a lot more sense. Because when you'd be like on a battlefield and you'd cast darkness, and what would happen is that the whole battlefield would slowly become dark as the light went away for a couple turns. It says on the third turn, it becomes fully dark. And then the spell reverses and the lightness comes back. And this clearly has a real world analog. It was clearly meant to be an eclipse. Right? Your high level wizard was actually summoning an eclipse to confuse and obscure the enemy on the battlefield. And that just has a lot more flavor for me. That has a lot more arcane trickery that, you know, actually did happen. You know, if one side knew that was happening in a battle in the past, that would actually happen. So I wish that the darkness spell had continued to be some kind of concrete real world thing like this high level eclipse that was happening. And so that always bothers me a lot about D&D. Also, I'll just point out that coincidentally, we have a solar eclipse that's happening in the Northeast tomorrow. And kids, you know, don't look at the eclipse tomorrow with your naked eye. It's going to damage your eye. So I just wanted to get in there that you need some kind of protection. Eclipses are very dangerous. Be very careful tomorrow.
That's funny. That's funny. Yeah, I was going to mention that's very timely. I had no idea that it was meant to emulate an eclipse. That is fascinating. I'm trying to find it here in the book, Dan. I'm paging through. Where's the darkness spell? Where is it?
Where is it? Good question. It came up in the first supplement. I think it came up in the first supplement, I do believe. The Greyhawk supplement, if I'm correct. Yep.
Gotcha.
So on the one hand, that's a little bit of a late April Fool's joke. That's not literally my top grief in D&D.
Oh, okay.
But it is something that I actually do correct in my book of spells. I actually do edit that and make it so it's a spell that wipes out lanterns and torchlight and things like that. And that actually is something that I do that I do like to correct, frankly.
Yeah. Interesting. So what is the text we're looking at here? This is from not OD&D, I take it, but from Chainmail.
This is from Chainmail. My preferred version of it.
I found it here in the Greyhawk supplement, and I'm seeing a spell which causes total darkness within the indicated area, making even infravision useless. It can be countered by either dispel magic or light spell. The end. I will say you're right that the spell has been problematic ever since. Right? There's always questions of does it create this orb of darkness? What does it look like from the outside versus what does it look like from the inside? What does or doesn't work in there? It's all very, very odd. Yeah,
and it seems like a spell that ought to help someone with infravision. Like it seems like if I'm a resident of the dungeon or a dark elf or something like that, like what I want to do is put my enemy in darkness and then I can use my infravision to gain an advantage and then you can't. So it seems like very mixed message with this magical, no one can see. Like, why would I want to cast that? It seems very unclear. So yeah. Anyway, we should move on. Let me say other stuff from that I find that was either better or stuff come out of Chainmail. So to be perfectly serious, a lot of the things that I actually really do get irritated about original D&D, or I should say am happy that I and other people have evolved past, are the scaling issues. And I've written a lot about that in the past on my blog about trying to get the scaling issues correct. And I will say, like, you know, that's something that what I do, what most of us do, and what actual published D&D, we all agree what the correction should have been, is that the scale of play really should match the miniatures if you're going to use them. And that comes out to about 1 inch per 5 feet. And it's kind of like obvious what really should have happened. But that wasn't the case. If you're not familiar with original D&D, that was not the scaling originally. And there was enormous confusion around what the scale was. And for me, the initial big mistake was back in the Chainmail Man rules when Gygax did not define any scale for it. So you've got the Chainmail Mass rules, that's great. And then you have an addendum of you could fight with like one miniature represents one person, man-to-man scale. They didn't give any scale at all, no time, no distance. And we were really kind of at sea as a result. I think they were kind of trying to do it on the cheap or just not think about it, even though they were very careful about that in other games or other parts of Chainmail. And not having a scale there really caused a cascade of kind of confusion and problems later on. So among them later on, you know, when we see D&D, it's like, well, the scale is going to be different in different locations. It's 10 feet indoors, but it's 10 yards outdoors, and your archery is different, and your move is different, and your spells have different ranges and areas as a result. So the scaling was different than the miniatures. The height didn't match. The area your miniatures take up doesn't match. Your ranged weapons are hyper accurate. Your ranged weapons are wildly wildly over accurate. If you're aiming at a single person like 200 yards away, that's still a problem we have in D&D today, is they just tried to just copy paste the archery rules from. And so, as I've said a number of times, shooting at a barn or a field full of men, you can't miss. But shooting at an individual person at the same range is effectively impossible. And that wasn't dealt with at the initial time. And we still have this problem of like over accurate ranged weapons as a result. And the movement was weird and the movement was too slow and all kinds of problems by not having a scale thought out either in chainmail man-to-man or D&D. And in fact, Gary, I pick on this first because this is something that's unusual. Gary actually apologized for it. So if you pull up the text that I have with a red dot, and I think this was in Dragon number 15, pretty early on, pointing out the problem, and I think that it was Len Lakofka that actually pointed this to him, is that the spell areas were changing, right? So fireball indoors catches 20 people, and a fireball outdoors, since the scale is now measured at 10 yards per inch, catches 400 people or something insane like that. And here in this article, there's an entire full-page article where Gary says, clearly we can't let this happen. That's ridiculous. And along the way, you see there's a number of unfortunately's in here. And in the second paragraph, he says, more unfortunately, the blame for the possible ignorance of player and dungeon master alike rests squarely on my shoulders, Gary Gygax. It would have been a small matter to explain to everybody. And he's got this italics. Later in advanced D&D, this turns into this like section of like super screamy all caps. He says, I should have explained that the outdoor scale is used for range only, never for area of effect. So the ranges of your spells changes, yes, but the area does not. And you do this unless your model constructions are the right scale, then you should do it, but you shouldn't do it. But then you shouldn't change the movements, and then the scale of the figures, which seems to me just gets more and more complicated. And then at the end, he says, I ask your collective pardon for this neglect, and I trust that the foregoing will now make the matter incredibly clear. There are distortions of scales in D&D, but despite the distortions, we hopefully have an enjoyable game anyway. And right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The other thing I'll point out is that in this text, he kind of goes a little bit of like, anybody that's familiar with wargaming would know clearly you can't let the areas of the spells change. Anybody should know that. But he made the exact same mistake in Swords and Spells. When he wrote the Mass Combat Supplement for original D&D, he's got the exact same mistake embedded all through those rules. And he can't really legitimately claim that anybody that's experienced with wargaming would know that, because he himself has made that mistake. So anyway, here's a case where if somebody says original D&D was perfect and it was heaven sent and there's no mistakes in it, here's a case where Gary himself is apologizing for obvious mistakes.
I mean, I would say that maybe this is tangential to this or a factor in this problem, but like I would say that it is problematic in OD&D that it fails to decide what opinion it wants to have about use of miniatures, right? Like I and I'm not saying that you should draw a hard line between whether or not you should or should not use miniatures, but I feel like the text should be opinionated, right? It should have an opinion, and it can certainly offer the other option as a secondary. Optionally, you can or can't use them, whatever. But I feel like it waffles back and forth about like, well, in these cases, do use miniatures, in these cases, don't, and we're not really sure. And, you know, and then it, right, like maybe don't use miniatures, but also all our combat's based on chainmail, so you have to use miniatures. And I don't know, like, and I feel like, frankly, that's an issue that has then been inherited by every edition of D&D since. And you get all these oddities, right? I certainly would say, like one of the classic things I see players confused by who are brand new to old school D&D, when they're picking up the text and they see things expressed in inches, and they're like, inches? That's it. What a tiny, tiny range. And you go, well, no, that's assuming you're using miniatures.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. My take would be that among, I guess the way that I would express that same thing is that they made a mistake, particularly in advanced D&D, of letting those inch-based ranges become vestigial. They weren't playtesting them. They were just copying them forward from chainmail. They weren't playtesting them. They weren't checking whether they were reasonable. And a lot of places, you can't literally fit as many miniatures as they claim in an inch if you try to do it. So the fact that they kept the inches, didn't update them, didn't test them, and they really became broken later on as a result. And like, and the thing I literally can't get almost anybody to grok is that if it wasn't bad enough that the ranges were expressed in inches, which were supposed to be 10 feet indoors and 10 yards outdoors, and then you get to the AD&D DM's guide and they say, yeah, you read the inches as that's what they mean, but if you actually play with miniatures on the tabletop, don't use those scales. Instead, use 1 inch equals 3 1/3 feet. So you got to if your spell is 40 feet, we're going to list that as 4 inches, but then at the actual table, it's going to be 13 1/3 inches. I didn't even get that right. It's too hard. I don't even think I got that right now. Maybe it's ridiculous. Yeah. So that was allowed to become broken.
All right. I can't disagree with you, and I'd be shocked if anyone disagrees with you on this one. But like, yes, the scaling is painfully bad.
I'll fight them. I'll fight them, Paul. I'm ready to go.
Dan, let me share with you mine. I think at least one of the biggest gripes I have about OD&D is specifically the rules for multi-classing, which I'm going to put up on the screen right now. So there you go. They're the rules that OD&D gives us for multi-classing. Sorry, being a jerk. Obviously, there are none, except for like a weird offhand comment in the elves section. Right. That just says that they act as both magic users and fighting men, and good luck figuring that out. Right? It's just so sparse. It's so sparse on this, and it's left us head scratching. And then you get things like basic, you know, BX D&D where you get race as class, and then you get, you know, dual classing and you know, level caps, and like it's just been inconsistent from edition to edition to edition of how the heck you deal with a character who maybe has two classes.
Totally agreed. Allow me to complicate this. But Paul, you're making it too simple. Paul, you should look at page 10. Look at the top of page 10.
Great. Top of page 10. Changing character class. Oh, good lord. While changing class for other than elves is not recommended, the following rule should be applied. In order for men to change class, they must have a score of 16 or better in the prime requisite, see below, of the class they wish to change to, and the score must be unmodified. A cleric with strength of 15, for example, could not become a fighting man. In any event, magic users cannot become clerics and vice versa.
Did that help? I mean, there's some rules.
No. And now we're just bordering into another gripe I have here, which is freaking prime requisites. And what do they mean? And should I use them? Should I give my players bonus XP, Dan, for having high ability scores? Yeah.
Blah. I think this was a mistake. I think that this was mechanically a mistake. You're right. So again, if newer players might be surprised that you have the classic 6 ability scores in original D&D, right? In a different order. We're not going to talk about that. But yeah, like Paul's saying, the primary effect, they have almost no very, very small mechanical adjustments in game, like to hits or AC almost don't affect anything whatsoever. Most of the abilities don't. The primary thing that they do is they change your experience award schedule of either adding 5 or 10% or reducing. That's the primary thing that all the ability scores do. And it's complicated when you're awarding XP. Now you have to go in each separate character and do this percentage adjustment. So it's complicated. It's not super interesting. It doesn't really fire your imagination that anything really interesting is happening. It has this very complicated, unclear, you're supposed to, at some points in a different ability, are supposed to adjust another ability, maybe only for this purpose. Maybe it actually reduces the other ability. Maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's just an accounting thing that people have debated since forever. And I agree that a much more interesting, and again, that's something that I agree with. Modern D&D has discarded those XP adjustments. And it's much more interesting to actually have the ability scores affect something concrete in the game. Like, can I hit better? Or can I dodge better? Or do I have a higher saving throw? Is a much more interesting mechanic, and that should have been there instead of the experience adjustments, which were, they were an idea that someone had one day. It wasn't the best idea.
I want to share a comment here from the chat. Jerry McDonald says, "Grr, never liked prime requisites. It's almost like they brought them up or thought them up just to give the ability scores a reason to be there."
I agree with Jerry. I agree. Yep. That's what it looks like.
Yep.
Yeah.
That is what it looks like.
Agreed. And you can it was like it's the same thing for every class, sort of, right? It didn't take much on the day we needed to make something up. It didn't take a lot of creative output to make that happen. But we could have done better. Totally.
Anything else, Dan, to say? Because I kind of took us on a tangent there, but anything else to say about multi-classing or changing classes or dual classing, prestige classes, kits? What else do we have?
Stop. But I agree. Right. The elf rule, right? I mean, the first thing you threw out was the elf rule, and that already has been a point of confusion debate about what it was meant to be. And what it says, elves. So I will say this, right? Some people are confused that original D&D clearly does distinction between races and classes, right? Dwarves can only be fighters is what it says. A lot of people say, oh, original D&D had race as class, but that was actually a later simplification by Tom Moldvay in the BX rules, which, we like, maybe with that one exception. And so for the elves, it does say in original D&D, elves can begin as either fighting men or magic users, and freely switch class whenever they choose from adventure to adventure, but not during the course of a single game. So that on the face of it, that sounds super weird. That sounds super weird that you start off on an adventure and you got to pick one or the other class that you're actually currently operating in. And so like, why do I even have this? I'm never going to get to the benefits of both. I might as well have two separate characters. Personally,
pick apart that language a little bit, Dan, and say, like, what is a single game? What are we talking about? One night of a session? Are we talking about an adventure, a level? Right? What point can my elf decide to flip? Unclear.
That's fair. I mean, you got to keep accurate time records, and I'm not sure what the units are. So there's been debate about should you take that literal you only get the benefits of one or the other per night. Some of us say you can score your experience in one or the other as desired. In advanced D&D, then it became you must split up all your experience exactly 50-50 all the time, no choice involved. So that has been a point where I suppose if you to take a positive spin, it's produced a lot of creativity about ways that people could possibly run that. But wow, that's a really super confusing rule. Very unclear.
Yep. All right, moving on, Dan. What else you got?
Okay, here's a couple things where I think I know where you agree.
One.
We haven't made it more than 7 pages out of volume one. I think that... here's some things I know that you and I are going to agree on. The gold standard for the economy, right? Okay. Yep. Gold is fun. We want gold. Okay. But they priced all the equipment and all the basis of everything is priced in gold, which is like crazy overinflated. And still to this day, published D&D still has the gold standard. And everybody says you can't make any sense of the economy in D&D basically because of that. And if they had just started out and said that our basis is silver coins, like you and I play with the silver standard, it's actually pretty close to real world economics in the Middle Ages. And we could have had something that would have allowed us to study and learn and research and kind of use real world stuff on that, you know. And then again, that's one of these places where in advanced, Gary spends half of a page defending the ludicrous economic basis with some kind of, you know, made up rationale, when it could have just been where most of us are using silver coins to buy a sack or a donkey. And that would have been right. It would have been very easy.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, I would say there's almost a little more nuance there, in that just the economy in the game is weird and broken. And I do like the fix of applying a silver standard, but I would say that's probably not even perfect, right? Because of this gets very complicated, but like, I like tying experience points to gold, right? Because it, or treasure, let's say treasure. I like the tying of experience points to treasure because it puts the focus of the game on the accumulation of treasure, which I think is the point, not necessarily killing things, right? And I like geometric progression of experience points to level. I find that interesting. It's a nice balancing fact for how to introduce new characters, etc. I know lots of people probably would, some people would disagree with me on this, but I like that you can, you know, basically a brand new character coming into first level needs as much XP to catch up to the rest of the party as the rest of the party needs to gain one level. But it does mean that if you combine those together, you get this massive inflation of the treasure that needs to come out during the course of play as the players progress in level. So by the time they're up there in 8th, 9th, 10th level, they are getting,
yeah,
like economy-destroying amounts of treasure, right? You've got a band,
this is true,
a random band of heroes wandering the countryside, yeah, who could easily decimate any village by just dropping a bunch of money on them, right?
This actually is true. If you run the numbers, the amount of money that has to come out at higher levels is just Brobdingnagian. I think most of us agree the scale of the game was kind of thought out up to about ninth. And after that, there's a bit of a hand wavy of you can just keep going to any level you want. And that was largely about as much thought as was put into it.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
Initially, the biggest monster had 10 hit dice initially, right? So clearly there's this like kind of 1 to 10 scaling that's built in. And after that, things are not well extrapolated.
I mean, except for summon elementals, right?
Good point. Yes. Right.
But yeah, I agree.
Might have to look that generally up, but yes.
Yeah. Generally, I agree that, like, yeah, we might even flag that as a mistake. Like, why didn't they just cap the level at 10 and say that's it? That's the highest level of the end.
That's an interesting question, actually. And, you know, some of us do that in their Warriors of Mars game that came out the same year, 1974, I believe. They do that. The highest level is capped at 13, actually. John Carter's 13. Nobody else in the game can be 13th level. So that was on the table as a possible design choice. Yeah, why didn't they do that for D&D? That's a fair question.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I mean, you know, like spell progression certainly makes sense, right? Generally, you're gaining access to new levels of spells every other level or so, right? So, you know, the highest level spells, you're getting at around level 10. Probably 11, actually, right? Because there are 6th level spells. But anyway, point being.
Yeah. Let's talk about the attack process. Process, right?
Sure. Okay.
So, if you pull up the pre-draft, right, and some of us now have access to this based on some legal documents that were released, if you pull up the pre-publication draft of D&D, and I have this in a image with an orange label on it, Paul, and it's interesting because some of us, namely, some of us working on OED, could detect this years ago statistically, that this had to be the initial rule. And thanks to our friend John Peterson, who could confirm that at kind of an early state on his blog, But I could actually, you know, I'm one of the people that could figure out that this clearly had to be where the D&D attack system came from. And so the rule as written in the text, right, before any tables were inserted, in the highlight here says the basis for our attacks will be the assumption that a man, a normal man, requires a score of 19 or better to hit an opponent in plate mail and shield. And then armor classes will be given in such a way as to indicate their efficiency, that is, to deduct their number from 20, and the base number to hit is then obtained. So for example, plate and shield is armor class 2. So if you do 20 minus 2 is what he's trying to say there, you get 18, which has an off by one error in it. Let's not talk about that mistake. But clearly, right, a very simple rationale for the attack system of 20 minus the armor class is basically what a normal person is supposed to need to hit. Or in other words, the armor class is the chance in 20 to hit. So armor class 2, basically 2 chances in 20 to hit. And if you, and then, very simple rule, and it wasn't included in the publication. You do not see this in published D&D. It was not there. It was stripped out. Instead, and my understanding is that Gary's players had trouble with that subtraction. And look, they're not alone. They're totally not alone. If I have a new player who's never heard about D&D sit at the table and I start asking them to do even the simplest math, adding or subtracting, they're going to initially hiccup over that. They're not thinking about doing, you know, arithmetic. I get it. So Gary, to make that more easy, I guess, inserted a table of just like, here's all the results. And that's on the next page of the draft. It's an image with yellow. Okay. And you can see here, you have the armor classes, and then over the top, it says 20-sided die score to hit this level fighter. And the level of fighter goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and then stops at 9, like we're talking about. And so clearly the whole system is based on one fighter level gives you one extra pip to hit, and one AC is minus one chance to hit. And it's, again, it stops at 9th level basically. And then when they expanded to higher levels, it doesn't, as we said before on a prior episode, it doesn't fit in the digest sized book. So this is as many columns as you can show in your digest sized book. And then they started to collapse the columns. So it would be fighter level 1 to 3 and fighter level 4 to 6. And then maybe there's an accidental overlap someplace. And I don't know which of the columns is supposed to be the 6th level or something like that. And for at least, you know, a decade or two, there was this misunderstanding that the table was just a summary of the real world that had never been visibly put in front of anybody. And the whole idea was every single fighter level is supposed to give you one extra point to hit, which is interesting and makes sense. And so I think that is an enormous mistake. Is instead of the tables, they should have just presented the original, very simple arithmetic formula. And then if you want to make a table for your players on a full page piece of paper, go ahead and do that. But making it a mystery where this very simple, this very linear, one level is one pip, that's a beautiful, elegant mechanic, and they should have made that visible to players, and not making that visible caused all kinds of problems. And then we're dealing with different tables or optional columns or THACO or my own target 20 that a lot of people like to try to resolve and simplify that math. But boy, that was a mistake not including that.
Yep. And you know, leads to all kinds of, you know, madness down the road with the proponents for and against THACO, and then eventually ascending armor class, and, you know, never quite pleasing everyone, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
And it's such a simple rule, and it was hidden and invisible for most of us up until this year, frankly. Right. So it was hidden and invisible in the murk for about 50 years. And if that had just been there in the first place, it would have streamlined. And we would maybe still debate exactly how to perform that mechanic, maybe. But boy, that would have simplified so much for so many of us for a lot of years.
Yep, for sure. Yeah, I'm looking at the chart here, Dan, that actually shows up in my book, and of course there's your your summary columns. Yeah. The 1 through 3, 4 through 6.
And then if you look at the monster table, right, look at the monster table on next page, and you'll see this problem that I'm talking about whereby some of the columns overlap, right? There's 2 to 3, and there's 3 to 4, and there's 4 to 6. So what column should I use for 3 hit dice or 4 hit dice? Or 6 hit dice. There's all this overlap.
Very confusing. Very confusing.
Right?
Yep.
What the heck's going on there? And if they just said 1 hit dies, 1 extra pip to hit on d20, right, you can fix it yourself.
Yep. No arguments here on that one. Anything else you want to dig into here, Dan? I feel like we've maybe run through the entirety of Volume 1, with the exception of the spells. Do you want to talk about the spells?
Well, I at the top, I did my gag about darkness really should have been Eclipse. So I think I'm...
Yeah.
Okay, how about this? Maybe I'm going to get a little spicy, Paul. In Volume 1, clerics were a mistake. Clerics shouldn't have been there. That was a big mistake. They don't fit in the pulp fiction. They're off book. Anytime you're simulating other books or other literatures, this idea of armored, in original D&D, they were clearly Catholic. Armored Catholic miracle making, fighting in plate mail priests are not part of any literature or any kind of pulp fiction app whatsoever, and really cuts against the grain of what they were trying to simulate. It makes campaign building difficulties. It makes this one character that you're highly dependent on for your special healing. And as a lot of people know, I do take them out of my D&D games. And I think, and again, they were kind of half-assed, frankly, right? Fighters, I get it. They're warriors. Magic users as wizards, of course, that's in all kinds of pulp fiction. And then you come in clerics and they go, well, basically what we did is we merged the two. Clerics are, they're kind of fighting men, they're kind of magic users, and we just sort of took an arithmetic mean, really, of the two of them. That's not great game design. That's not super imaginative. And I get it that one of the original players had a vampire in Arneson's Blackmore game, and somebody else wanted a way to counter that. And so Dave, to my understanding, made up this cleric class to make them happy. And we were kind of off track at that point. So I will claim that having clerics in the book was a mistake and shouldn't have been there.
Well, Dan, you're well documented in this opinion. I'm not sure I completely agree, although I definitely see your argument for it. And in some realms I do agree with it. And these days when I'm running OD&D, I do play that way. But that said, I know often you like to interpret the introduction of the thief class in Greyhawk as the correction to that mistake. But I would submit that thief skills are a terrible mistake. The thief skills are so odd. They're so odd, right? And they're all these different percentage numbers for these very specific things that are all off by maybe 5%. Your starting off first level thief is basically not capable of doing any of them, right? It's statistically highly improbable that they will be able to perform any of the things they are allegedly skilled at.
Totally agree.
So, you know, and I know that you house rule that as well, right? In OED, you come up with a single unified thief skill rather than all these crazy percentages.
Yeah, and it's a bunch of 5%.
Now we're also introducing a need for percentile dice. Is that what's going on here, right? Like we couldn't just express
percentile
this
dice.
In
I'll point out that it's. I'll point out that it's a roll low mechanic, right? So when you express, which is a natural thing to do, it's a natural thing to do. When you express a first level thief's chance of removing traps at 10%, right? Percentile dice are generally used by roll low. That gets, it's still the case in advance. They try to, then there's a mechanic that deals with like additional difficulty, which becomes super complicated because it's all turned on its head. The increment's all 5%, so it could have been on a D20, like the attacks and the saves. Why didn't they do that? And I will say that in my games, the main thing that I do is I generally allow thieves 3 retries. And that's right. The book technically doesn't say you can't retry. It didn't say you can't retry. They didn't explicate that one way or the other in the original game. So I try to personally deliver on that promise by saying for most of my thieves can retry 3 times before I call it quits that they can't do something. And that obviously increases the chances of something slightly more reasonable. Dexterity bonus? I mean,
does that apply, Dan, to every thief skill? Because I understand where you're coming at with, say, retrying picking a lock, but what about retrying hiding in shadows? Surely if you fail the first time, someone sees you, no?
That's an exception. You're right. So picking pocket, opening a lock, removing a trap, those kinds of things I allow 3 times. But there are things that doesn't make sense for. Totally.
I'm gonna go back here just real quick. Because it brought us to the thief skills because you were potentially thinking of it as a replacement to the highly broken cleric. There it is. Sorry, I'm delaying here because I'm trying to find it. The highly broken cleric class. And I want to post a piece of chat here that showed up in our chat from one of our viewers. It says, despite being problematic, the cleric class is my favorite to play. And I'm assuming that you yourself, Dan Collins, wrote that. Is that right? viewers may not realize that this is absolutely true. That Dan Collins, when playing in anyone else's game, if they allow clerics, will play one. Will absolutely play one.
Yes, this is true. Totally hypocritical.
This
is true. My longest running player character was
Nate, if I'm pronouncing their name right. I mean, I apologize if I got that wrong, but claims to really like clerics. And I also struggle with this because I do view clerics as a classic part of the IP, of the fantasy realm, is that we're just so used to seeing them at this point. It does feel a little weird to not have them. But I also do like the argument of them being, you know, when you go back to the pulp fantasy, that generally they're reserved for the enemies. Frankly, they're usually not the heroes of the story. They're evil high priests, right, and cultists, stuff like that.
Right.
Yeah.
If there's somebody in a monastery, like my natural idea of a, let's say, pagan priest is someone in a monastery, someone in like a wild man in robes who's pacifistic and has, you know, some kind of plot-based way of healing or possibly resurrecting or removing a curse or something like that. Like that's what pulp fiction-y, you know, magical priests feel like to me, not this like do everything for everybody fighting in plate mail type situation. Again, I think back to the first Liber Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser story, which feels so much like D&D, and they're in a dungeon, and then they're joined by the priest of the Holy One, and he says, "I'm completely invulnerable because the great Holy One protects me," and he walks into the next room and squashed like a grape. He's dead immediately. Ridiculous. Of course that doesn't work. Of course it doesn't work.
Excellent. Dan, we have about 15 minutes left here in the show. I think you're going to have to start cherry picking your favorites because we're not making it through this whole thing. What else do you want to call out here as being highly broken in OD&D?
Was it a mistake to have non-human races? Was it a mistake to include hobbits and elves and dwarves? There are days where in most of the pulp fiction, that's not a thing. Conan, Elric, Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser, you see main characters that are non-humans. You don't even see mostly, you know, nations of non-humans interacting, right? It's different types of humans in different parts of the world. And I think that we got D&D at a moment, you know, there's a very small number of pieces of literature prior to that that had non-humans there. You know, arguably, maybe you could point to Three Hearts and Three Lions that had the main character who was a paladin, had a henchman who's a dwarf, where arguably we get the whole Scottish talking dwarf thing. Wasn't really the primary character. And then, of course, you have Tolkien. And So this is a moment where historically where Tolkien became super, super popular. And, you know, Gary and Dave borrowed, obviously, hobbits and elves and dwarves and a bunch of dressing from Tolkien to, you know, to pull in players. I mean, they were interested in it themselves. I get it. But, you know, maybe the core rules should have just been humans. Maybe we could have had some interesting, probably would have been problematic at this point, interesting ideas for people from different nations with maybe different statistics or abilities or skills or proficiencies, maybe. And then maybe the non-human stuff could have been like a side appendix, like bards or something, could have been an option if you want to go really crazy. And we could, you know, because there are days when, like, I really wish that elves, you know, were still mysterious and scary and potentially, you know, stealing your children and doing illusions and chaotic and things like that in a lot of literature. And we don't have that because we're so familiar with elves. They were made a player character race. And so there are days when I'm wondering, like, maybe it was a little bit of a mistake to make the dwarves and elves and hobbits like core possibilities. And now we expect, frankly, every single thing in the world to be a player character race in modern D&D. And maybe that was where we got off track on that. Maybe.
Interesting. I mean, certainly I understand where you're coming from of wanting to retain some specialness or unusual, you know, mystical feel to the non-human races. I'm sure we have Tolkien to blame. I mean, there's so much, you know, despite his protestations otherwise, there's so much Tolkien in these books. You know, I think that is what they're after. Yeah. Oh, let me posit this. Or let me ask you this question, Dan. Let's assume that D&D is trying to emulate a Tolkien novel. If that is our basis of understanding, do you still want to eliminate dwarves and elves and hobbits as playable?
You know, I put them in an appendix.
Yeah.
Put them in an appendix.
You know. What about this? I what about just making them very difficult to land into? And my counterpoint here is the paladin. So I remember, you know, I think we all probably all remember the old school, like playing AD&D paladins and knowing just how difficult it was to actually roll up a character who is a paladin. I very distinctly remember once being with a group in summer camp where we had 20 kids who had all signed up to play D&D. And it was way more popular than they were ever anticipating. And they were like, okay, well, we're going to split this up into smaller groups and run multiple campaigns. But for now, since you're all here in the room, let's have everyone roll up their characters because we can all do that as a group. And out of the 20 kids, I think we had one paladin and everyone was very excited as they watched this one kid roll up a paladin. So what if you had the similar thing for dwarves or elves or hobbits where they're just that difficult to create? Still possible, but highly unlikely. Does that solve the problem at all?
I kind of like that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't mind it. I kind of like that. I think we get tastes of that in some like iterations. I think like in maybe even BX has minimum ability scores for some types. You definitely have that in AD&D, I think.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. The numbers are not high though, so it's not particularly difficult to be you get a slight skewing towards human, but not
right.
It's not a rare exciting thing.
I like if it was leaned into harder.
Yeah.
I don't mind it.
I can also see your argument though of like just put it in an appendix, right? So make it something you have to opt into. Yeah. The default setting is all humans. Oh, you want to play dwarves?
Yeah.
Sure, here's the appendix. I don't know though. Some might argue that that's what happened in Chainmail, right? Chainmail was about just medieval combat and like, oh, we put the fantasy stuff in an appendix. And obviously
Keep it like that, you know, because it's interesting, because at least it's interesting that you can at least begin to think about, is D&D trying to play a Tolkien story? Because you basically can't play a Conan story. even though Conan is actually referenced more often directly in a lot of stuff, you can't out of the box play a Conan story. You can't play an Elric story. You can't play a Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser story. Really, there's more of the, you can't play a Lovecraft story, really. There's more of the literature that you can't play because of this expansion than if the basis had been, you know, different interesting types of people. To play, you know, devil's advocate about that.
No, I see your point. It would definitely be a different thing, though. I think there was a comment in the chat. I've already kind of lost tabs of it, but like, is that what made the game popular? Right? Would the game be as popular as it is if it had those limitations in it? I don't know.
It's a great question. It's a legitimately really great question. I'm trying to get like throw the hard questions out here as we get deeper into the show. Here's one other thing. The mechanics should have been roll low. The mechanics to hit and to save and all these things, right? The natural thing, right? And we're familiar with you roll a d20, 20 is the best thing. But frankly, the more natural thing would have been to roll low. And it actually makes a lot of the expressions of what you need to roll easier. It makes the, you know, with Thaco, even what we saw here, the original thing is you have to do a subtraction. You have to do a subtraction to see what your target number on D20 is. But if the initial mechanic had been roll low, then all those things would have been an addition instead. And that kind of stuff would have been a lot more obvious. And you can see that the, you know, prior wargaming, you know, prior military wargaming, you'd get your field data in percentages is the natural thing to do. And then to randomize, you're coming up with a percentile number under that. It's kind of the obvious way to create a hit mechanic. There's an obvious interpretation involved that, you know, one or two or three or four is the error or the variation in how close you got to a perfect hit. So there's a really obvious statistical interpretation that it means something what you're rolling on the die. Higher numbers are further away from your bullseye, and you can see that even though, you know, coming out of chainmail, they wanted to have this higher numbers or better to hit, they kept stumbling into the more obvious ditch that really low numbers are better, and you see that in the thief percentage skills. Right? They accidentally made it there. You see it in all of the D6 mechanics, and we had an episode just about D6, is that all the open a door is roll a 1 or 2 on a D6. Listen, you know, hear a noise is 1 or 2 on D6. Surprise, doors, hearing stuff, traps, everything on a D6 is all roll low in original D&D. And I think that if they had the classic mechanic, roll under your ability score, right? I have strength 15. I want to do some kind of feat of strength. It was pretty common in the early days of, grab a D20 and roll under your strength, your intelligence or whatever. I started, you know, if I bring that up a table now, it's confusing to players. And I've had some players see that for the first time in the last couple of weeks. And if the hits and the saves had all been roll low, that would have been synchronized with roll under your ability, roll low on a D6. Roll a percentage chance. And it would have, you know, nowadays you have this issue of why do I even have the ability scores on my character sheet? The only thing that matters is the modifiers. And that's because the universal mechanic got away from the whole roll under a number idea. And we just don't see that anymore. I'll even point this out. If you could pull up the,
Give me a minute to respond, Dan.
Just one more piece of evidence. If you pull up the green.
Okay, so I'm muting Dan, so we can't hear him anymore. You're welcome, everyone. Sorry. Couldn't help myself.
Brilliant. Brilliant.
I understand your evidence, but I want to disagree. I have to disagree with this, Dan. I will agree that a mistake was made in that it wasn't consistent. I agree that it's inconsistent and that's bad. And I would prefer if they had decided universally roll over, roll high is good, and just applied that throughout. I don't like that there's some stuff that's roll under and some stuff that's roll over. But I've played games that do roll under, right? Warhammer fantasy role-playing game is classically roll under, right? A lot of the Palladium games are roll under. It's not as satisfying because at an emotional level, the way people interact with numbers and dice, which are associated with gambling, is that big numbers are better. Big numbers feel good. And I've never felt that same level of excitement that I get from a natural 20 as I do with like an 01 on a percentile die trying to roll under a skill. It's just not the same. It does not have the same emotional draw.
Am I actually muted right now?
No, you're not. I'm sorry. Okay. That was kind of a jerk move on my part there.
I'm throwing out some bombs right now, and I respect the jerk responses back. I deserve that. I totally concede that we'll never get away from this, right? I do feel that this is our built-in expectation, and now it's built in not just D&D, but all role-playing games expect this. And much like the fact that our notation for electrical flow is backwards from the way that the electrons are actually running, I get it. We'll never fix it. There's no hope for that. But I feel that it's the same kind of cultural expectation. And if I think if I get brand new players and I put a roll low mechanic in front of them, they don't have any problem with it. And the 100 looks bad and the 1 looks great. So I get that we're not going to fix that. Let me just, if you could you pull up the green slide? And I will just point out that again.
I'm giving you 1 minute left here, Dan, because we are actually almost out of time. So
I totally understand.
The green slide. Okay.
Yeah. So this is Dave McGarry's original character sheets from the Blackmoor campaign. Big thanks to Dan Boggs. I get this off Dan Boggs' website. And I know that Dan is in the chat right at the moment. Also with things like we should have had the D6 hit die and damage explicated. So thanks to Dan for that. And a giant list of skills of all the abilities and all the different weapon types that we see in chainmail. And higher numbers are better. And as far as we can tell, the original mechanic in Arneson's Blackmoor campaign was probably like roll 2d6 and roll under this number. Higher numbers are better, roll under it. There's no math. There's no adding. There's no subtracting. There's no math. It's kind of the natural thing to do, and we got away from it. I understand there's no going back, but I do think if we'd stuck to that initial instinct to all these things that just kept burbling into original D&D, it actually would have been simpler in a lot of ways. I think it might have been a mistake.
I understand that from a statistical mathematical perspective, I understand the arguments for roll under, but I still think that when you're interacting with a physical object like a die and you're rolling it, that it's hard to separate yourself from the emotional response of expecting a bigger number to be better on the die, on the physical object, not talking about stats or anything like that. But that is the gambling moment, right? That is the risk moment of I'm throwing this object on the board and I'm looking to see what number comes up. And I've just never experienced the same rush with a looking for low numbers as I do with looking for big numbers. And maybe it's just training. Maybe it's just ingrained in me from decades of expectations. But I think that there is something in the human psyche there that expects a bigger number to be better.
Might have to agree to disagree on that one, Paul.
Okay.
Might have to.
Fair enough. Well, Dan, we are out of time, so we're going to have to. We have no more time to try and hammer this out. Any final thoughts on errors in OD&D?
I mean, here's something we all agree on. Original D&D is a great game, right? It's vibrant. Mm-hmm. It's full of energy. Nothing's perfect. We're looking at this with 50 years of perspective behind us. As we'd say in the music business, real artists ship. They got the game out and we got to enjoy it even with the blemishes. They didn't try to perfect it. So mm-hmm. with some perspective, we can fill in some rough spots and we can keep making it better. And I love that about original D&D.
Yeah. I mean, no art is ever done, right? As they say. It's, you know, If they had tried to make it perfect, they wouldn't have made it at all. And I appreciate the game for what it is. And yeah, even if they had made all the decisions that you and I just iterated, I bet we would still have things that we'd say, I don't quite like this. I'm going to change this rule for my table. right? Because that is just, I think, the human nature of GMs. We just like to house rule stuff. We just like to customize to our needs. So, yeah. Viewers, if you have any opinions on this, if you have any specific rules that you think we missed out on, big glaring error in the OD&D tech you'd like to call out and we should maybe talk about in a future episode, leave us a comment right here in the YouTube comment section. We'd love to hear from you and maybe integrate that into a new show down the road.
Definitely. And of course, remember that you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, TikTok. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all the sites. So please deconstruct that like button.
If you prefer to listen to us in audio-only podcasts, you can do so. Those files are available on our website at wanderingdms.com and through various podcast carriers such as iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, Pocket Cast. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those other sites and they offer the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We really, and as usual, big thanks to our patrons who support the show here. And if you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. Like Paul said at the top of the show, we have a bunch of different tiers. Every tier gets you access to our Discord server, where the conversation continues throughout the week, 24/7. And we would love to see you there in that. We'll be on our Discord server for the continued video after chat in about 10 minutes, like Paul said. And we're both going to be there today. Yes, Paul?
Yep. Yep. We'll see you there.
Upcoming shows on the channel. I'll be back Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern time for more of Dan's old time mini show. And I should throw a shout out to next week. Hope you'll, this was a great show this week, by the way. And we're looking forward to next week because we're going to have a guest on that we're looking forward to, an up and coming author named Mike that we know. Michael Moorcock is what I see here. Is that
yep.
right, Paul?
Yep.
Does this make sense?
That is right. That okay. is right. None other than Mike Warcock joining us on the show next week.
So I guess he's got some literature that's making a splash. I guess he's got a character named Elric, I think, that maybe we'll be talking to Mr. Michael Moorcock on next Sunday. That'll be April 14th. And so we hope that you'll be with us live and in the chat, and maybe we'll get some of your questions in front of Michael Moorcock if you have them, because I know I have a whole bunch. So we're really looking forward to that. I hope you'll join us next week.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to that, too.
Yeah, right. So, we're live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. Please join us again next week with Mr. Michael Moorcock for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.